You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is Alex Phoebe. He's author of the extraordinary novel Lucia. We'll also hear from Gaynor Clements about the Cambridge Writing Retreat. And Malcolm Gaskell and Alinka Rublack will talk about their books on witches and witchcraft. But first of all, hello, Alex. Welcome.
Hi.
To the show. Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're talking to Gaynor Clements later about the Cambridge Writing Retreat. Do you have a place you go to write?
No, not really. Wherever I can find the time.
Really? Do you end up in coffee shops and on trains? And
often in class. I teach, so when I give the students writing exercises, I write then. And I write in the bedroom, I write in the attic, the shed, obviously.
Really? You can do that? You can just sit down anywhere?
Yeah, you have to. I mean, I think, you know, lots of people get very precious about writing, but when you're very short of time, you've got to turn it on and turn it off, otherwise things don't get written.
Well, that explains a little bit about your book, maybe, that it's kind of these, we'll discuss these short blocks of narrative.
Sure.
Really, I mean, do you think the writing process fed into that structure?
I think it also is a book that needs to be written in short chunks because they're usually pretty hard to read and intense. So it suits a shorter structure. I can write long in parts, so it's not necessarily part of the function of the writing process, but it does play into it, certainly.
Well, we'll listen to your first choice of music now. These are all slightly unusual choices of music, I think it's fair to say. Is music important to you?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I tried to think about pieces of music that had some relationship with the text. The last book I read was much, much more informed by music, particularly Wagner. And there is some Wagner in this too, but these ones were more, I think, thematically similar. So I thought.
Well, the one we'll start with is War by Sinead O'Connor.
Sure.
Why this one? Why this one?
Well, because I think lots of reasons. It was one of those moments in a singer's career where essentially she kind of detonated the whole thing, as well as having shaved her hair off. This performance on Saturday Night Live essentially ended her career. It was the one that you might remember because at the end of the performance, she ripped up a picture of the Pope. On late night American TV to absolutely dead silence from the crowd. Essentially she's been having a hard time of it ever since, I think.
So why does it appeal to you?
Well, it's about child abuse, which I think Lucia is also about. It's about appropriation. She's singing a cover version of Bob Marley's War, which is primarily about racism, and she's using it to look at child abuse in the Catholic Church. And I think it's also about the way women get silenced, particularly if they have something uncomfortable to say. And that's certainly the case here. So she had something very uncomfortable to say about the Catholic Church, something that we now, even the Pope, admits to. And one of those things that essentially ended the career of a very talented woman. And I think that was thematically very similar to the kind of stuff that I'm writing about in Lucia.
Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited.
Now, there she was, ripping up that picture there. That was War by Sinead O'Connor, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Alex Phoebe. Alex has master's degrees in critical theory and creative writing and a PhD in critical and creative writing from the University of East Anglia. His first novel, Grace, was published in 2009. His second, Playthings, came out in 2015 and was shortlisted for the 2016 Wellcome Book Prize. His third novel, Lucia, came out earlier this year. Using shards of narrative, it focuses on the life of Lucia Joyce, daughter of James Joyce, lover of Samuel Beckett, and a gifted dancer in her own right. The Spectator described it as exquisitely written. The Guardian said Alex Phoebe is a writer possessed of unusual, indeed extraordinary, powers. And the Irish Times said it was emotionally powerful and constantly questioning. Well, Alex, yeah, it is an extraordinary book. I enjoyed it. Yes, I did enjoy it, but it is very, very challenging. You must have been aware of that when you were writing it, how challenging it is for the reader.
Yeah, I think. I mean, as a reader myself, as well as a writer, I like to be challenged by things. I mean, even as a kid, I preferred books for adults rather than books for children. And I think there's room for intellectually challenging work. And if you pick certain subjects, you have to go where they take you. And this subject took me in an intellectually challenging direction. My next book is a fantasy novel. So that wasn't perhaps as intellectually challenging. In some ways, mood and tonally, it's quite similar. But I think Lucia Joyce, James Joyce, modernism all speak to a particular type of approach. So I didn't shy away from that. Also, I'm in the privileged position of working with Gallibega Press, who are known for their difficult books, their readership is very acutely able to follow the kind of things that we writers who publish with Gallibega put out. So I think the audience and the techniques used fit quite nicely. And it's certainly not my aim to talk down to people. So my feeling is that the reader can probably cope.
You didn't shy away from it. You didn't ever feel, you know, I need to compromise here, I suppose. Shying away would be that.
That would be it. I mean, I don't think there's any need. There's no requirement on me, certainly. I haven't got like an agent badgering away to write less interesting material. It wasn't really an issue. I just went where it took me. And that was where it took me.
Well, it's about Lucia Joyce, as we say, daughter of James Joyce. Why her? Why was she the subject of this novel? What was it about her story that attracted you?
Well, it's one of those things. I'm a bit of a kind of completist, I think. When I've had an idea about something or someone has given me an idea and I've begun a project, I tend to finish it. So when I was writing Playthings, which was about Daniel Paul Schreiber, the schizophrenic German judge, I was working with Lindsay Stonebridge, who was an academic working at UEA at the time, and she mentioned Lucia Joyce. She mentioned her as someone who kind of neurotically wrote her father's work out and illustrated his manuscripts, which she did a bit of, and I looked into her life. So that was the spur that started me on, just a suggestion by someone I respect. And from that point, anybody, I think, who looks into the life of Lucia Joyce will be fascinated by it, because it's such a kind of fascinating and terrible tale, one that has been dealt with by lots of other people. But my feeling was that I still had something to add.
It is a very sad story. I mean, for those who don't know, she spent most of her life, was it in a mental institution?
From her late 20s onwards. So she was in sanatoriums in mainland Europe, and then eventually ended up in Northampton in a hospital for most of the last period of her life, and largely unregarded by her family and friends. So she was on her own.
So when you decided, you know, there is a book in here, a novel here, what was your starting point then? Because the way you've structured it, which we'll come to later, is quite unusual.
Well, my feeling was that it wasn't my place to do what the most obvious thing would have been to do, which would be to fictionalize someone's life from birth onwards, largely because it's a problem of voice, I guess. I don't want to be seen to be ventriloquizing a woman who's been silenced, because I think my position as a white middle class male in the 21st century precludes me from doing that ethically. So what I wanted to do really was to trace out what was left after her letters were famously destroyed by her family. And a lot of academic work on Lucia Joyce has been suppressed by the Joyce estate. And those things that are left kind of hover around in this kind of weird void, not making much sense. And my feeling was that I could use those kind of fugitive pieces that exist after an attempt has been made to silence something as the basis for a kind of novel in reverse, like a silhouette. This was my aim. I was going to make an image of Lucia Joyce by tracing the black parts of the silhouette and kind of finding some way to say something without having to do something as ethically problematic as ventriloquizing. So I went in first with the idea we knew where she died. We know where she's buried. We know who she, the kind of things that happened to her by some surviving medical records. We know from her James Joyce's letters, the kind of medical treatments that she underwent. We know about her lovers. We know about people's reactions to her. We know some of her work, even though that's very fragmented too. She danced for Jean Renoir. And this film, so we can see the edges of those. And the aim was to piece together something on the edges of her life that I would be feel comfortable writing, but also that allowed me to address essentially the misogyny that I think marred her life and mars the life of many women. And whereas it's not my job to stand in and speak for people, I can certainly speak against particularly misogynistic traits in male culture. So this is what I was aiming to do.
And you talk about the things we know there. Do we know why her letters were burnt?
To stop people reading them, essentially.
So what was in them that was
well, then we're left to wonder, aren't
right,
we?
This so is we don't know the content.
No, we could. This is one of the reasons why. I mean, I think the idea is that Stephen Joyce wanted people not to pry into her and James and Nora's life and Giorgio's life, and in attempting to prevent that privacy invasion, he kind of blew up an enormous amount of supposition in the academic work. Most of the things that are in the book are pre-existent in the writing on Joyce and the discussions that go on at Joyce conferences and the various things that people say about Joyce and Lucia Joyce. So they're not my inventions, but they are things that are extant on the basis of the fact that people will read into voids whatever they wish. Which
and
is
have
part
you
of
had any
about.
Contact with the Joyce estate?
No.
You don't need to. We'll find out.
We'll find out. No, I haven't had any contact with them. My feeling is it's a work of art, and consequently it draws its inspiration from the world. This is the world. I'm not breaking any confidences. I'm not inventing material that people haven't already said. Where I am doing that, I'm doing that for artistic effect. So,
and let's talk about the structure there, which I alluded to, because it alternates between these various voices, as you say, of people involved in the life of Lucia and the discovery of a tomb in Egypt and information about what Egyptians believed in the afterlife.
Sure.
Why did you, I know you don't want to give all your secrets away, but why did you decide to use those voices?
I've always been fascinated about ancient Egyptian religion. That's one of the first reasons. One of the things that my first degree was in art history, and I really was fascinated by Egyptian tomb decorations and the religious kind of thought that went behind those. Largely because, and as much as the fascination continues into the writing, is because I feel that particularly British appropriations of that culture have been very heavy-handed and unfeeling. My sense is that if an entire culture believes that the afterlife of its people is secured by tomb decorations and mummification of the corpse, it's probably not fair on us to drag those things out and stick them in a museum thousands of miles away and all go and stare at them and point. There's something inherently wrong about that, I think, and it's always struck me as wrong. And as someone who was studying that as an art historian and feeling the wrongness even as I was doing it, I think that's one of the first reasons why I was interested in using ancient Egyptian art as a kind of structuring metaphor for this book. But it also allows me to make more obvious some of the things that are going on in the main run of the text, so that people can find a way of contextualizing what is otherwise a quite fragmentary narrative. And I think it helps this very linear narrative of someone discovering a tomb and deciding that it's been desecrated and then wondering what they're going to do about it. That played out in order has the effect of making the rest of the book seem more chronologically linear than it is.
Yes, it runs like a thread.
It does,
through the book,
yeah.
Doesn't it? Which
so you
the
can
other
hold
chapters
on to that.
On to.
Because the chapters are quite short, so and as are the introductory kind of sections. So you can read one of those, feel as if you're anchored. feel becoming less and less anchored as you go through a very short chapter and then get re-anchored on the next one. So structurally, it's not a trick, but it's a way of allowing me to do things that are more experimental with the main run of the narrative without people becoming bored and listless and lost.
And did the idea to do that come at the same time as you decided that you'd use these short bits of narrative?
The idea of doing something came, but there were various things. I had another version with people doing dinner table seances that was going to go at the beginnings. And then there was another version about people discovering letters. But this one, I do a lot of experimentation, so it will depend on how the final draft kind of meshes. But this version seemed the most appropriate and most satisfactory. Everybody liked it the best.
Well, thank you, Alex. We'll come back and talk to you in just a moment. But speaking of women who've been mistreated and witches in particular, Malcolm Gaskell is Professor of Early Modern History at the University of East Anglia and author of Witchfinders, a 17th century English tragedy. He spoke at the Wimpole History Festival in the summer along with Alinka Rublack, Professor of Early Modern European History at St John's College, Cambridge. Her book, The Astronomer and the Witch, focuses on one of the most notorious witchcraft trials of the 17th century, that of the mother of astronomer Johannes Kepler. I met them after their history festival debate entitled The Witch Craze and asked Malcolm why he thinks we're still so fascinated by witches.
I think there's something about witchcraft that strikes right at the kind of the heart of the human condition. It's always about everything. I think Alinka and I would often say to people it's about politics and it's about gender and it's about sex and law and, you know, but it's also about individuals having fantasies and about families at war with each other. And I think there are some kind of universal themes, even if the subject matter seems essentially supernatural and strange. And I think it's appealing because it's alien, but I think it's also that there's enough in these stories that's familiar that means that they are kind of like universal dramas that we keep being drawn back to.
And universal drama, but this area in particular was quite a hotbed of action during that time.
It was. I mean, the 16th, 17th centuries, where there were all sorts of political, economic, climatic and religious crises, witchcraft really gets its sort of negative energy, its power from this particular conflict from that time. And that's why it's so intense, because this is a great period of change.
But this particular geographical area here in East Anglia,
East Anglia, yeah. Well, it's really bad here in the years 1645-7 in East Anglia. It's during the Civil War, there is political division and conflict, and there is also religious conflict as well. In fact, the Civil War is largely about religious differences. Witchcraft accusations in this time feed off those kind of tensions and anxieties, but particularly because there's an active witch finder, Matthew Hopkins, who goes around asking people, do they have suspicions, and encouraging them to come forward and take those suspicions to law.
Yes, how much of that time and what happened is driven by him?
He takes all the blame a lot of the time, but actually he orchestrates what others actually put together in terms of a case, so that sometimes these suspicions go back decades and there are resentments and animosities between neighbours that don't really have an outlet as a witch trial until he comes along and brings it out. So he's an essential catalyst, but he doesn't cause the witch hunt. That's really much more deeply embedded in religion and society, politics and culture.
And Alinka, your book looks at a particular trial, the trial of Johannes Kepler's mother. Where did you first come across this story?
So I first was in the archives 25 years ago and I saw these two enormous boxes with files because everything kept being kept about this trial. Kepler was a contemporary of Galileo, so was one of the top scientists in his day. And when he first learned about this, he was at the height of his fame and he absolutely panicked. His mother had been accused and that would mean that his whole career would be at the stake.
We can use that story to illustrate wider points about what happened to women during that time.
What it shows us is how long these accusations often dragged on, these trials. I mean, it's a 6-year-long trial, which puts tremendous pressure on the family and strain on everyone involved. And on, of course, the women above all. I mean, at the end, she's chained to the floor for 14 months in the prison, carted to a town where she's never lived before. Incredibly difficult circumstances to live through.
So how much research, years of research you must have done, but where do you stop, I suppose?
in this case, what was so fascinating is that we know so much about Kepler, and he wrote very personally about his life, and we have many of his letters, so we can really get a sense of his personality. And that's what really I wanted to focus on, to get a sense of this woman's biography, because she's been often said to be witch-like, and I can show in the book that that's totally not true. She was not witch-like. She was a very ordinary person who was dragged into this trial and then defended by a very heroic Kepler's son.
And what happened during this time? This tells us not just about society's attitude to women, but about their relationship to religion, superstition, etc.
Yeah, I think it's also got a lot to do with some rather more mundane things than superstition. It's often got to do with property and land and how you start a family and the kind of anxieties that surround making your way in the world, raising a family and so on. They're all points of conflict around that, and witchcraft is an explanation for failures at any one of those weak points. So again, those are things that I think are very familiar to us, those kind of frailties, these human frailties, but we just don't attach supernatural significance to those things. It's a mixture of the familiar and the alien, but when that really came together in real people's lives in the 17th century, it could be extremely explosive.
Do you think something like that could happen today?
You never know, and people's fears are, of course, as deep as they were then. But, of course, we've lost the whole worldview around it, so I don't think, you know, that witches are current in that sense anymore, but we've got, of course, our own panics and witch-like figures, and must always be very, very careful about acting on stereotype.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is really about questions of liberty and power, and that really they stay with us, because, you know, if you take liberty for granted, then actually what you find is that it gets someone else, sort of infringes upon it. And I think that's a lesson that the witch trials often tell us, that it's about order and the need to actively defend freedoms and liberties, otherwise there'll be someone else who comes and takes them away.
And The Astronomer and the Witch by Alinka Roblack is published by Oxford University Press. Witchfinders, a 17th century English tragedy by Malcolm Gaskell, is published by John Murray. I'm talking to Alex Phoebe here on Bookmark, author of Lucia. Alex, I read that review from The Spectator earlier on. Before we started recording, you said, the review from The Spectator. Well, let's go back to that review from The Spectator, okay. Because it said it was exquisitely written. It also said that the book had questionable ethics because you allege quite a lot about the relationship between Lucia and her father and her brother and her uncle. You allege incest.
I'm not sure about quite a lot. I mean, if you concentrate very heavily on those bits to the exclusion of all others, then yes, certainly that's quite a lot. But again, these aren't my allegations. They're allegations that are current in the understanding of the field. I mean, when I wrote the book about Schreber, my job was to read up on Schreber. When I wrote the book about Lucia Joyce, my job was to read up on Lucia Joyce and to speak to people who had something invested in that area of intellectual study. And those rumours, those suppositions are inherent in a lot of the work that gets done, particularly recently, on Lucia Joyce, particularly the big biography To Dance in the Wake. So my feeling is that to have ignored that would have been to do a disservice to the material, right? And also, I think there's a certain degree to which this book is written from a perspective of someone who has been silenced, right? Those are the coming in at the edges. This is the part of the stylistic and mood work of the novel, is to feel aggrieved in the manner of someone who has been silenced. So the slightly hyperbolic nature of some of these suggestions and parts of the text that deal with incest are from that perspective. It's not from a kind of factual perspective where I've written a biography about Lucia Joyce and I'm now stating these things as fact. There are things that are kind of half suggestions, things that are suppositions, things that are informed by that material which circulates around this story anyway. Now, it seemed important to me not to ignore those things and to foreground them because it's one of the privileges of fiction writing and for fictional authors to be able to say things that aren't necessarily true, right? On the assumption that people will understand that this is a work of fiction and not of fact, even if And this is a big one, even if it happens to be based on the life of someone who existed. Now, it is ethically problematic. I don't have a problem with people pointing that out. And it takes you into uncomfortable territory. But I think the book does the work of answering those ethical questions itself without having to invoke me or my ethical position, right? The book, I think, has within it sufficient material that it answers all of those questions as you read it, particularly those parts where it calls itself into question, which it does. It calls its own ethics into question. As we were talking about earlier, the structuring narrative of the discovery of the Egyptian tomb is about desecration. It's about the desecration inherent in looking at things that are private, like a corpse. And part of the honesty inherent in that authors who write on biographical material, fictional biographers, should include in their work is this idea that they are doing a form of desecration, even if they are doing it for good reasons. And I don't think that's something I could shy away from. And again, it was something that came across in the writing of the piece, and I wasn't obliged to remove it. And I didn't feel it was necessary for my reputation to only say things that other people would like. So I did it.
Okay, thank you, Alex. Yeah. I hope the Spectator reviewer is listening to that.
I mean, Claire wrote a very nice review of Playthings, and I agreed to meet with Claire. We haven't met up yet, but she's a very intelligent woman, and lots of the things that she said in her review are accurate, including the bit about it being exquisitely written, but for the other parts too. And she's not wrong to have noticed that that these things are ethically problematic. My feeling is that that they are sufficiently problematic, right? And that the book answers those questions. So I don't think I went over the top.
Okay, Alex. Well, I was going to say, let's move on to something lighter, but your second piece of music is Wagner. Yeah. it's you describe this, Götterdämmerung.
Yeah, it's from Brunhilde's story arc is pretty sad in Wagner, even more so than in the Eddas. She eventually decides that she's going to set fire to heaven and punish the gods by building a pyre and immolating herself and Siegfried's horse on it. And this is from that scene. One of the reasons why it's relevant is because some of the work on Lucia Joyce picks up on the fact that she was a massive Wagner fan and argues that she was a bit of a pyromaniac in places. And some of the arguments that get made rather poetically is that a particular instance of her setting fire to a tablecloth are in a kind of way of building a magical fire that she'd protect herself when her true love came, they would be able to rescue her. So there's a part in the book that kind of makes mockery of that. And I think, this was what inspired it.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
A segue from Wagner to Belle and Sebastian. It's not often you get that. Alex Phoebe is my guest on Bookmark today, talking about his novel Lucia. We're going to hear an extract from Lucia now. Alex, do you want to give us a brief introduction to this?
At some point during her incarceration's treatment in Northampton, she had her teeth removed. This is something that happens to people. And this is a section that takes that from the point of view, a kind of neurotic point of view of the dentist who does the removal of the teeth.
I would say it's not for the faint-hearted, no, this extract.
I'm not reading it, so it's dramatised.
Well, dealing as it does with teeth removal and with the treatment of women during that period, but here it is.
Mm. is called out to an appointment, ushered through to the room, introduced to the patient, and the nurse opens the mouth. It is a right mess at the back. Abscesses crumbling away. Significant degradation to the bone structure. X-ray like a bath sponge. Vacuoles on the cell diagram. A strong breeze and this lot would be out like tiles slipping from the roof and smashing in the drive. Like slate pieces chipping his paintwork. He'd sand it back. Prime it. New layer of enamel and several hand coats of wax. Buffed to a shine. They're virtually out by their own accord, as if the teeth want to flee this tube of flesh and make a life for themselves alone, outside. These hard objects are disgusted by the softness they find themselves surrounded by. Couldn't a canine make a better go of it alone? It couldn't do worse. He gets the nurse to open her up wider and inserts a dental prop. Show him a strong tooth. Show him a structure that will take the teeth of a pair of workman's pliers. He'd have it done before lunch. His knee on her chest, brute force, one at a time, and ride back to the saloon to play poker and drink fingers of whiskey in the company of petticoated whores from the rooms upstairs. Painless Parker. This is more like archaeology. He'll have to pick up the tesserae from which this corrupt mosaic is figured, unpick them from the shattered superstructure, tease them out from the glue. It'll take much longer. If only he could chisel away the maxilla, grind into the mandible and get it all away. Start again with the new stone, cement it into place and slip the flap of skin over to cover the evidence. The sculptor would do it that way. Unhappy with the results of his apprentice, he'd show him how it was done. Let the master see the fox. Let the hounds watch the hunt. One heavy hammer and one sturdy blade and the whole skull would be gone from the Voma down, ready to accept a perfect replacement, carved in the workshop in awed silence. No. She won't wear the nose piece. Too jittery, too barking like a dog. She writhes in the chair, keening and whining like he is going to torture her. Even with the wrist restraint, she manages to get the mask off, whipping her neck around and thrashing. No need for thumbs. Opposable digits are not required for her mischief. It could be achieved by a fish thrashing about in a net, hook in her mouth. She'll tear the cartilage to pieces and die slowly in the shaded depths beneath a weeping willow. She'll drift into stagnancy where the riverbank is weak, damaged. Out of the current, out of eyeline and earshot, working against her own better interests. I'm not going to torture you. One and a half grains of pentobarbitone and he'll see her in an hour.
That was an extract from Lucia by Alex Phoebe. The reader was Isabel Rees and it was produced by Matt Bentman. Well, Alex, there's a lot about the physicality of Lucia in the book. I mean, it's quite graphic, very visceral at times. You obviously wanted to get that sense of her really physically there.
Yeah, I think so. But only from a distance. I think there are times in which it is very visceral. That's one of the times. And you might want to stick a trigger warning on that before it goes. It's like all a bit much. Yeah, I think it's one of the ways that you can bring people in, funnily enough, particularly if you're going to give... Some of the parts are quite abstract. So there's a ruminations on the Little Match Girl story because she danced for Renoir in his film, The Little Match Girl. And those parts are quite... surrealist, I think, in their tone, and difficult to kind of latch onto. So sometimes it's good to bring the physical back in front of you. The first opening chapter is very physical, and it gets physical in places where you need to kind of mark, because it hasn't got a traditional narrative. You can mark a kind of narrative progression in these peaks of physicality as you go through the book too, which is a kind of way of keeping people engaged with the progress of the novel without having to give them a story as such.
Lots of medical procedures.
There are, yeah.
Some of which are quite distressing. You did research.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's lots of film of these procedures being done. I mean, that's one of the useful things that the internet throws up now is that you can see training videos from the periods in which various medical procedures took place through things like the Internet Archive, which is well worth a look. And you'll see material that was presented as if it was completely neutral, that these are just scientific kind of procedures that one goes through, but which look extremely worrying to us now. Although, to be honest, many of the procedures that take place in the book still take place today, particularly with people who are sectioned. So the idea that we've come to a kind of enlightened place where people get dealt with gently is inaccurate.
And you tell these procedures often from the point of view of the person doing them.
Yeah, quite.
How did that feel, actually, putting yourself in the head
it's
of someone
odd.
Doing
I mean,
that?
It's I think the writer's job is to empathise and imagine, which isn't to say that it's easy. It's the writing of the whole book felt tension-inducing in a way that stuff I've written in the past doesn't. It might explain why I'm moving on to fantasy for the next one, because it's a bit lighter in tone. And the process of writing it is less grueling. But I think, you know, I don't know, if I expect people to read things that they aren't necessarily going to enjoy, I don't see that I should also enjoy writing them. That seems unfair. So the fact that I wasn't, that it was hard work for me is an indication that I was probably doing it correctly, because it's a hard subject and the book is grueling's not the right word, because it does have an upward trajectory as you get towards the end. But it is a challenge, yeah, certainly.
Well, thank you, Alex. Well, you say lighter tone. Let's go to somewhere lighter in tone now. Writers in Cambridge wanting to get away from it all without travelling too far in order to knuckle down and write need look no further than the newly launched Cambridge Writing Retreat, situated in the quiet village of Ellsworth. It's run by Gaynor Clements from her home, Avenue Farmhouse. I went to look around and asked Gaynor why she decided to open her own home up to writers.
Well, it's something I've wanted to do for a long time, actually, many years. I've been on Arvon Foundation retreats and holidays, writing holidays, and I've always thought I'd love to do that. And it was sort of in January this year when I was walking the dog, I thought, actually, I could open my house and do day courses. So that's what I'm doing. I'm starting with day courses, hopefully, maybe in the spring, running residential courses, maybe over a weekend. The house is away from the beaten track, if you like. It's in a village. It's a nice village. We've got lots of garden spaces for people to come and write. The house itself, I'm opening up the ground floor to the pupils of the retreat, and the kitchen, that's where the workshops will happen, in the kitchen. I think it's a nice, tranquil place to be. It's the sort of place that I would want to be in if I were, well, I do write. I want to get away from my house. But, you know, if you want to get away from your house, you can come here for a day's retreat. I will cook for you. You can just come and write. There'll be no tutors on those retreat days. But on other days, there'll be tutors to run workshops in the morning. And then in the afternoon, you can go and take yourself off into the garden or part of the, you know, downstairs in the house, and just write and reconvene maybe later on, talk to your peers, perhaps get some feedback on your work from the tutors as well.
As you say, you're opening up your house. That is a big step, isn't it? Letting people you don't know, really, into your home.
It is, actually. But I work on the basis that most people are lovely, and writers particularly. They all have the same aim in mind. I'm sure people will come and look at my artwork and bits and pieces and think, not sure about that. Equally, they might think it's a really nice place. Yeah, it is a big gamble. I've got to sort of work around my family life. My husband works from home, so he's going to have to make himself scarce. It is a big step, but I'm compelled to do it. It hasn't in any way been an obstacle. I just think people are, on the whole, appreciative and trustworthy and nice, and they'll enjoy the space and respect it.
And why do writers need a retreat?
Writers, well, if you're like me, you've got great plans to do various things like start work at 5:30, get up, do a bit of yoga and start your writing. Never, ever happens. So I think people need to get away from their own environment. I need to get away from my own environment sometimes. There's always the drawer of the washing machine or the dishwasher or someone knocks at the door. And very few people have got the, well, is it willpower? I don't know, to just ignore those distractions. I certainly haven't. So I know that for me, I would like to get away somewhere that's convivial with other people who are writing, talk to other people, get ideas. I also think it's important that the tutors that I've got this autumn are all fantastic and all published writers. So it's important to go to people who know what they're doing and to be taught by somebody who's been there, given ideas, inspiration, and be able to pick their brains. I think that's a really important element of that, that people who come here are going to be taught well. But if you don't want to come and be taught, you just want to hang out, I will look after you. The whole point of this for me is to nurture. I don't think we're nurtured enough in our lives. We don't nurture ourselves. It's something that I would like. I'd like to go somewhere and be cooked for, looked after, have people around who are of like mind. So that's it, really. It's a nurturing and inspiring place to be, and hopefully people will come away either having got over their writer's block or started a new poem or cracked that plot line or whatever, you know. And you can do that in a day if you can focus, and most of us can't focus.
So it'll be a mixture of days where people can pay to be fed and watered, very nice food that you'll provide, and get space to write. Yeah. And then other days when there'll be tutors here in the morning, and then inspired by those sessions, they'll spend the afternoon writing.
Yeah. Well, actually, the tutors are here all day, so they'll be around to sort of give feedback on work, hopefully, and also to do sort of a plenary session, a roundup session at the end. So I've got my dog.
Yes, I mean, it really is a family home, so you've got three dogs.
Yeah, I've got three dogs. One is currently with his head on my lap. I mean, the emphasis is on writing, but I do think it's nice to not have any distractions, and you don't even have to pack your own lunch. You can just turn up here with your pens and paper or your laptop and just write, and I'll give you coffee and some nice biscuits when you arrive, and then I'm planning to make some nice, simple vegetarian lunches. We've got a big vegetable garden, so season permitting, I'll cook from the garden. Yeah, salad, soup, simple homemade, wholesome food, homemade bread, that sort of thing. And people just have their lunch and then wander off into the garden and carry on with their writing. I haven't found anywhere like this. There are places around where you can go. I don't think they're as tranquil or as beautiful as this. Or places you can go, you take your own sandwiches sort of thing. But this, it's a slight, dare I say it, a slight step up from that, and slightly unusual in that you have to go to the Arvin Foundation to find something like this, but that's a residential course. They're very expensive, they're very far away, which is obviously part of their charm in that they're remote. But this is accessible. This is very close to Cambridge. We're 10 miles from Cambridge, an hour from London. So it's accessible and affordable.
Well, yes, let's talk about affordable then. How much are these courses?
Well, the courses, for a retreat day, it's £45. For the tutored courses, it's £80 for the day. So I think that's quite good value. I've done my market research. Me and my marketing guru, Alex, have done the research, and we think that's pretty competitive. You can go to London and do a poetry school course for around the same price. I don't think it's, again, as peaceful and as tranquil as this place.
And you mentioned your own writing there. Yeah. What writing do you do?
Well, I did a master's in creative writing at the UEA about 7 years ago. I did what they call the prose strand. Then I never wrote a word of prose after, which is unfortunate, but anyway. And I was always trying to write short stories. Well, I did write short stories. I was never interested in writing a novel. It just never appealed to me. I wanted to write short stories. And when I look back, really, I think what I was trying to do was write poetry. I was trying to do the distillation of the language and ideas. And I wrote poems when I was a little girl. I loved poetry, absolutely loved poetry. And I memorised Tennyson's Lady of Shalott when I was about 11. And I loved the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam as well. And then I went to university to study English and I had all the love of poetry beaten out of me. Not literally. And then I rediscovered it after my prose master's, and I've been writing quite seriously for about 5 or 6 years, and I've had a few poems published, I've won a couple of competitions, I'm currently working on a pamphlet. But poetry for me is brilliant because you can actually pick up your computer and edit a poem when you've got 5 minutes. I was always under the illusion you had to sort of clear sort of a weekend in order to get something done. I mean, but actually you don't. You can do it in a day, you can do it in half an hour, you can do it in 5 minutes. I take my laptop everywhere, and if I get 5 minutes in between ferrying my teenagers around, I'll revise, you know, rework a poem.
Gaynor Clements there, working very much like you, Alex Phoebe there, talking about Cambridge Writing Retreat. If you want more information about that, it's cambridgewritingretreat.com. Well, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Alex Phoebe. We've been talking about Lucia, which is published by Galley Beggar Press. So what now for you? So you're working on a fantasy novel?
Yeah, I mean, that's done, really. I'm just polishing up. I need to give it to them by Christmas. So I'll be working on the next literary fiction book after that, so which is... I don't know, 10,000 words in, I guess, which is another complicated one.
Is it dwelling on, examining mental illness? Because that seems to be a subject that particularly interests you.
No, let's say no for this one. And it's, there's no asylums in it either, so that's good. So I've had done three now with asylums in. So
it's an asylum-free novel.
Yeah, asylum-free. It's about a picnic this time, so it's all outdoors. Right. It's about Sylvia Bataille, who was... the wife of the surrealist philosopher Georges Bataille and also of Jacques Lacan, the psychoanalyst. So it's a book about her that reconciles Bataillean surrealist philosophy and Lacanian psychoanalysis, set around a picnic.
Wow. Set around a picnic. Well, more something for everyone.
Yeah, indeed.
A question we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've just finished reading because I went to Canada to do a book tour, and I've just come back, and so I've read quite a few books. The best one, or the one I was looking forward to most, was the rediscovered first novel of Patrick Hamilton, Monday Morning, which Faber Fiennes was trying to find for ages, and they said they'd found it, but they, for some reason, couldn't get it produced. So it's come out with the publisher, I can't remember what they're called, but you'll be able to Google it. It was good, very much in the Patrick Hamilton mould, any Patrick Hamilton fans, but much lighter, very much more kind of Tuppence coloured than Hangover Square. It was really enjoyable.
Excellent. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment to hear what your last choice of music is. Before we hear what's on the next show, let me just give a call out, really. Bookmark listeners may remember about a year ago now, we spoke to Sarah Stamford, writing as Sarah Shaw, about her book Portland Peace, a memoir, really, a secret diary of a 1970s secretary set at the BBC and her relationship, her extraordinary relationship with an older man. She's since been commissioned to write a follow-up to that book, bringing together the memories of others who worked as secretaries in that decade. So if you fit the bill, or you know anybody else who fits that bill, who worked as a secretary in the 1970s, then do contact Sarah. The way to get in touch with her is via secretariesoftheseventies.blogspot.com. If that doesn't work, then just find us here at Bookmark and we'll put you in touch with Sarah. Our next show, studio guest is columnist Anne Atkins, talking about her new novel, An Elegant Solution, which is set in Cambridge. We also hear from Ted Powell on his book about Edward VIII and his relationship with America. And Leda Kindersley, she carves letters in stone, designs typefaces, runs the Cardozo Kindersley Workshop in Cambridge, and writes books. We'll be talking to her in the next episode of Bookmark 2. But we'll sign out now, Alex, with your last choice of music, which is Act 3, Scene 3 from The Ruins by Philip Glass. Yeah. This one.
It's from a series of operas. This one's about Akhenaten, the pharaoh whose records were basically removed when a dynastic change took place. So he tried to introduce monotheism to a polytheistic culture, and it lasted one kingship, and then his son got rid of him. But he's famous for having the very beautiful wife Nefertiti. And this is from towards the late in the opera.
The sun of him who knew thee not has set, O Amun, but as for him who knows thee, he shines. The temple of him who assailed thee is in darkness, while the whole earth is in sunlight. Whoso puts thee in his heart, O Amun, lo, his sun hath risen. The new ruler, performing benefactions for his father Amun and all the gods.
Cambridge 105 Radio.